Excuse me.
Oh, wait. We have to start this meeting. Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. We're going to go ahead and call to order the meeting on the Senate Committee on Workforce. Today is Wednesday, March 22nd, 2017. Today we are going to have, first we need to have a work session, just real quickly here on Senate Bill 139. And then we're going to have some informational meeting on PERS once again. So I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 139 and ask Deborah to summarize the bill, please.
Senate Bill 139 appropriates $2 million from the General Fund to the Oregon Department of Administrative Services for the construction of and capital equipment for an innovation and workforce training center in the Rockwood neighborhood in Gresham, specifies appropriation is not in lieu of any other appropriation, declares an emergency, and is effective July 1st, 2017. There's no amendments, a fiscal statement has been issued, and the bill has a subsequent referral to Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay.
Chair Taylor, I move Senate Bill 139 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and subsequent referral to the Committee on Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 139 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? The clerk, we don't know if we need to call roll. We don't need to call roll, I don't think. I don't think so. And the motion passes. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 139, and then open an informational meeting on the public employees retirement system. Okay, so today we will hear about three separate issues related to PERS. First, we'll hear about the future of OPSERP. Then we will hear about the PERS board's structure, authority, and responsibilities. And then thirdly, we'll hear from the PERS technical experts on their analysis of Senate Bill 559, Senate Bill 560, and Senate Bill 913. So first, we're going to start with the future of OPSERP. And the first topic, we're going to learn a little bit more how it works and the structure of the program. And I'm going to call Steve Rodman, the executive director of PERS, John Thomas, the chair of the PERS board, and Matt Larrabee is the actuary from Milliman. And then the second item on our agenda today is talking about the PERS board structure, authority, and responsibilities. The same panel is going to be here to talk about that. So again, to refresh people's memory, the reason we are doing this is because we want to understand what is called OPSERP or Tier 3, what the structure currently is, and to get more information about not just the structure, the authority, the responsibility, the future of it, so that the legislature and Oregonians know that it is a stable program, and if there's anything that we need to do at this time to ensure its stability going forward. So why don't we start with you, Mr. Rodman?
Thank you, Chair Taylor and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Steve Rodman. I'm the executive director at PERS. I am pleased to be joined by Matt Larrabee on my immediate right, who is the actuary with Milliman, with the Milliman firm, which does he's the principal consulting actuary for his engagement here at Oregon PERS. John Thomas on my far right is the chair of the PERS board in his second term on the PERS board and has been chair for a number of years now. So I appreciate the opportunity to bring these folks in front of you and talk about their different perspectives on the questions of the dynamics of the current system that's in place, as well as the governance by the PERS board and where those decisions are made and how we can look to the future with more confidence that we will be having more predictable progress towards the affordability of the system without these unintended or unforeseen outcomes that have caused us to be the place we're at today with system funding. So to talk about the dynamics of OPSERP and the future of that, I've asked Matt to cover some of those basics for you, and then John will talk about some of the dynamics about the PERS board.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Again, for the record, my name is Matt Larrabee. I'm an actuary with the Portland office of Milliman, which is a big global actuarial firm. I've worked with PERS since 2006, and I've been the lead actuary for the system since 2009. So to the first agenda item, which is the design of the OPSERP program, which is the tier of Oregon PERS that the new members enter into since August 2003. you know, post-reform. The OPSERP design is what I would characterize from an actuarial perspective as a traditional final average pay annuity plan design. So we take a multiplier, we take it times service and times some average salary, and we get a projected benefit for the member in their retirement period. That is a similar structure to the full formula that the Tier 1 and Tier 2 members get. But, you know, something that's curious and I think is a point of interest to the committee from certainly from my perspective is if you look at the multipliers for the systems, we'll focus on the police and fire personnel, for example. Our Tier 1, Tier 2 members who are police and fire, their full formula benefit is 2% of final average pay times years of service. For our OPSERP members, it's lower. It's 1.8%. So the difference between those two features is about a 10% difference in the projected benefit for full formula on Tier 1, Tier 2, versus the OPSERP for our new police and fire members. However, from an actuarial perspective, something that I calculate every year is what I refer to as the normal cost. Normal cost is a technical term, but what it refers to is the projected economic value that I would attach to the retirement benefits earned in any given year by a PERS member, be it a Tier 1, Tier 2 member, or an OPSERP member in the third new tier. Even though the ratios between the multipliers for those formulas are 10% apart, if you look at our most recent valuation, the Tier 1, Tier 2 members, when you look at the general service and police and fire populations combined together, we were looking at a normal cost for last year of about 15% of payroll for the Tier 1, Tier 2 piece for those members. Compare that to the OPSERP piece for our new hires, and our normal cost rate that we calculate is about 8.6% of payroll. So even though those two multipliers are only 10% apart, the normal cost rates, which are the economic costs that I attach to the projected values of the benefits, they're nearly 75% apart. The difference and the reason they're not 10% apart and they're 75 has to do with the money match formula that was in existence for the Tier 1 and Tier 2 members and is available to them. And if there's kind of a discussion or an informational session on the OPSERP program and its path forward, is that that OPSERP rate, if you will, the value of those benefits cannot go up to the levels that we see for Tier 1, Tier 2 right now, and that is precisely down to the absence of a money match style formula in the OPSERP program when it was designed in 2003.
Excuse me. Yes, Senator Hanson. Of course.
Please.
A basic question I probably should know the answer to. If you have an employee that over the period of their time of employment, they actually spent time as a Tier 1, a Tier 2, and OPSERP as far as the benefit package was concerned. When they retire, do a portion of their retirement and some type of formula from each of those, the benefits they accrued under each of that the different contracts, I'm not clear of how that operates.
So, Senator Hansel, I am going to pass this question over to the current executive director and former legal and administrative compliance person for PERS, Mr. Rodman.
Mr. Taylor, Senator Hansel, the answer is that your whichever plan you're in is determined when you come into PERS. So when you come in as a Tier 1 member, you stay as a Tier 1 member until you leave the system. You can leave the system by withdrawing, or you can leave the system, unfortunately, by dying. But you stay at Tier 1 for your entire time. So your hypothetical where you serve some time as Tier 1, Tier 2, and OPSERP is not how it works. If I come in as a Tier 1, I stay at Tier 1. If I come in as Tier 2, I stay as Tier 2. If I come in as OPSERP, I stay as OPSERP.
You'll follow up?
But, yeah, follow up if I may. So, okay, I'm identified as a Tier 1, but the legislature has changed the retirement moving forward. So I don't continue to accrue at a Tier 1 level after the legislature has changed, do I?
Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, yes. Yes, you do today. That's not to say one of the concepts you're looking at, for example, is to reduce that multiplier that Matt talked about, and that law change would apply to the service. The new tiers that we create are for people that join public service after the dates they're created. So when OPSERP was created in 2003 and the multiplier was lowered, that lower multiplier only applied to people who started in public employment after that system was created. For everybody that was already in public employment, they stay under their old plan.
And if I can further clarify on that, Senator Hansel. So from an actuarial perspective, I mentioned what I call the normal cost rate, which is the economic value of benefits, and that for the Tier 1, Tier 2 members in our most recent valuation was 15% of pay. That 15% of pay is the average across all Tier 1, Tier 2 members, and also importantly, it is an average across the benefits earned over the entirety of their career. So that 15% metric includes kind of when the money match program was still getting new contributions in 2003. It is no longer getting new contributions, but it's still getting the crediting. That 15% is an average full career rate for those employees that I've kind of spread out over the entirety of their careers, reflecting that the benefits for a Tier 1 member do accrue a little bit differently prior to reforms and subsequent to reforms.
Follow up?
Oh, absolutely.
If we need to move on, that'd be fine too. Well, you just said, okay, a Tier 1, they had the money match. It went away in 2003.
Contributions no longer go into the regular account, meaning the benefit does not get any bigger.
Okay, so where do the contributions go then? You were tier, it goes into Tier 2?
No, it goes in the, my individual contributions as a Tier 1 member would go into my individual account program. 2003, those contributions were diverted into the IAP to slow the rate of growth of those regular accounts so that money match reduced the growth of those benefits and the prevalence of those benefits. But so, still, that's a Tier 1 member the whole way.
I got you. So let's see. I'm starting to click here. So it went into a different fund, but it did not go into what we would call a Tier 1 or Tier 2 fund. I'm still Tier 1, but the money then would be, okay.
It's a hybrid, correct?
Correct, Chair Taylor. Okay.
And then what happened with, if you were serving while you're op serve, is it goes into a...
So Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, op serve has always been a hybrid program, as Chair Taylor described it, where my employee contribution goes into my individual account, my employer pays a contribution to pay for the pension. So the multipliers that Matt talked about are all calculated on the pension side, calibrated to mean if you serve a full career, 45% of your salary will be replaced. Then you also have your OPSERP you also have the members' IAP contributions going over there. They're 6% of salary. That rises and falls with the market rate of return and will return something, calculated return something between 15 and 20% of your salary, depending on how well the markets do.
Okay. Follow up. Yes. So you would, a Tier 1 person that has worked through those would have one check, but it would be coming from a couple of different possible
buckets. Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, they would get two checks. They get their pension check and their IAP distribution, which they can take in a lump sum or they can take in installments. But they get two different sources of payment.
Two different sources, one check, though.
Probably two checks.
Two checks.
Yeah. We're working on it. We'd like to make it one, but it's two right now.
Thank you. Sorry.
Okay. This is what we do sometimes. We need to stop and ask questions. Anyone else have any questions for now? Okay. Go ahead.
That's great. So, I appreciate the questions always. A natural question that's been raised from me to time in my role as the actuary is, you know, obviously the system is in a challenging spot right now in terms of the unfunded liability that we calculate in our evaluation, the contributions, the increased contribution rates that we're projecting to occur if future experience is near assumption. And a natural question is, okay, what lessons have been learned? And, you know, how can we be certain that we won't be having a similar meeting or similar hearing 20 years from now? Mm-hmm. And it's the difference in the plan design between the OPSERP program for the pension, which is what the new members since 2003 get, and that kind of money match full formula design that the Tier 1, Tier 2 members received for those that entered the system prior to 2003. The difference in those designs is the major reason that I would be optimistic that we wouldn't have a similar situation arise 20 years hence.
Before you go on, what could go wrong with the current system?
So, the most obvious place where something could go wrong, given the current design, focusing again on the OPSERP tier. The benefits are calibrated to be a certain level of cost, and that's based on, you know, combination of the benefits being funded during the member's working career by a combination of employer contributions and actual investment earnings. And so where you could fall short and where you would run into issues primarily is if the actual investment earnings in the future do not get to expectation or near expectation, because the fundamental cost equation, which Steve has talked about with the committee before, the benefits equal contributions plus actual investment earnings, B equals C plus C. If E does not come through for you, C is what follows. The contributions will fill the hole.
So,
if I may editorialize slightly on what could go wrong. Matt talks absolutely about the major cost driver. But the other things that can happen, again, on that formula is what if there's a change to the benefit? So the legislature controls the benefit plan. Why we could be backer in 20 years is if we had an overly generous legislature that, for example, said retroactively everyone's 1.8% multiplier, let's make it 2.8 because we've had a great run of investments and we have a lot of money in the fund. I'm not speaking facetiously because that's how some systems get in trouble. They see a well-funded system and they say, well, let's enhance the benefits and let's make sure we include that enhancement for people currently in the system. As Matt said, funding is predicated on you pay as you go. So when you add those retroactive benefits, you create the kind of holes that you might create. I just had to, again, editorialize slightly as to why we come to you sometimes as a legislature and caution you about benefit changes, because they can have those sorts of spiraling effects.
Okay. So if there was a market correction of some type, such as what happened in 08, with our current OPSERP system, I'm sorry, I have to ask such direct questions, but this is what where we're at right now. We want to make certain that everything's in order going forward. If there were, let's just replay tomorrow's 2008, and there was that type of significant market correction, what would happen with OPSERP and with the whole program?
So, Senator Taylor, speaking to the OPSERP program first, is what would happen is that we measure, you know, the investment returns, because the contribution rates are set on a biennial basis. We measure investment returns on a biennial basis as well. And if we have a biennium where the investments do very poorly, like they did in 2008 as an example, we would have what we'd refer to as an investment loss. We would kind of quantify the dollar magnitude of that loss, and we would convert that dollar magnitude into a level percentage of projected payroll contribution rate to fund that loss and make it up over a period in the future. For the OPSERP program, the current policy is the rates that we calculate would be to amortize any losses that arise over a 16-year period, starting in the biennium after the rate occurs. And for the Tier 1 and Tier 2 program, which has a larger amount of assets right now and thus is more financially significant from an investment loss perspective, we amortize future losses over a 20-year period as a level percentage of projected payroll. And that would convey immediately and actuarially into the contribution rate.
Okay, so we would have two UALs we'd be paying down.
Correct.
Just to summarize that for everybody.
Question.
Yes, sir. Senator Canone.
Thank you, Chair Taylor. So Matt, I think I remember the slide that Steve presented as to funded status of OPSERP versus the others. And it seemed like OPSERP was maybe $2 billion funded of $3 billion worth of liability, something like that. It seemed like it was 67 to 70% funded, if I recall that correctly. So my question is, do you guys feel like that gap will be made up through earnings over time in the fund, or is there another adjustment that's going to need to be made to put more money into that fund to match its status?
Good question, Chair Taylor, Senator Canope. So, you know, we can't guarantee with certainty what will happen with the future investment returns. And so, you know, any given biennium, if the investments fall short of expectation, a new layer, however, whatever the magnitude needs to be actuarially, of contribution rate is created. And that layer will be funded over time and will continue to be funded unless future experience subsequent to that happens to surpass hoped for returns.
If I might, Chair Taylor, Senator Canope, yes. What you're referring to is that stacked bar chart that showed the assets
right.
and liabilities, okay. A thin, relatively thin slice for OPSERP, mm-hmm. and a not-so-thin slice on the liability side because we are slightly underfunded. So as Matt says, that underfunding is recognized and collected over the amortization period. That's why our employer contribution rates on an uncollared level include a 1.27% rate for the OPSERP UAL. That's to recover that thin difference over time.
Are you talking about from the 2015 that we didn't earn as much as we thought?
Chair Taylor, I'm talking about the valuation based on 2015, which includes all of the reasons for the unfunded liability probably in the OPSERP sense, yeah, a lot of that is driven by that under of not having earnings to accept expectations. Part of it also is a mortality change.
I'm going to, Chair Taylor, I need to make a very wonky actuarial point, which is what I tend to do. So we had an increase in the OPSERP contribution rate. That slice up to 1.2%. It was 0.6% in the prior biennium. And that was a minority of the reason for that was the investment results during the year. The bigger reason for OPSERP was we actually changed the methodology for how we calculate the rates, and we changed that methodology with the assent of the PERS board because we'd been using a certain methodology, and then the Governmental Accounting Standards Board said that they preferred a different methodology for financial reporting. I recommended to the PERS board that they move over to an aligned set of methodologies because the only thing worse than me coming in front of the PERS board and saying we have a $20 billion unfunded is going in front of them and saying we have a $20 billion unfunded, except when it's 22 using a different methodology. So we had a methodology change that upped the OPSERP rate for probably about 3 or 4 tenths of a percent of payroll.
What caused GASB to, what brought that? Talk about that another time. Anyway, okay, back to the, okay.
Okay. Okay. I can answer the question.
No, it's okay. No one else will. It's not relevant right now. So I'm just curious. These changing of these formulas with those kinds of dollar amounts are significant.
Yeah.
Anyways, okay, go back. Now we can just return unless anybody has any other questions. Sorry. Okay, we have to pay attention to time.
Yeah.
You're doing great, though. We're learning a lot. We appreciate it. So.
So I think as far as the future of the OPSERP program or its trajectory, I mean, I don't want to kind of be insensitive to time, go over, you know, slides that Steve's already presented to the group. I think he's done a very good job with those. So that's pretty close before we get to governance issues to the conclusion of my remarks on the OPSERP system, unless the committee has questions now or later at any point during the meeting.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Hello.
Thank you. Chair Taylor and members of the committee. So as indicated, this is my second six-year term, so my 6 years is up March of next year, and I've effectively chaired the board from the second meeting forward. How that came about, not quite sure, but got the letter from the governor, and so I said yes, I would do that. During this period of time, for 5 years at this juncture, there's only been two instances, and one was kind of an aberration, where there has not been a total consensus vote, 5-0. Now, remember, we represent...
Excuse me, I forgot. I need you to say your name.
John Thomas, Board Chair, Eugene, Oregon.
PERS Board, yes.
Thank you. Because there's different constituency groups that are represented, because we have a member of the coalition, we have an employer executive department head, and then we have three lay people, and they all have different backgrounds. There are some common denominators in terms of their financial acumen. But the primary responsibility as a board member is the fiduciary to the beneficiaries, and the beneficiaries are the PERS participants, and the beneficiaries are not the employers. So when you can have total consensus, that means that people are very much aligned as to what our real responsibilities are, and that's to make sure that there's sustainability, that the funding is correct, that there's checks and balances, and that there's no sidebar politicking that goes with being a member of the board. So I have a background in a graduate degree in finance and also some designations in terms of financial consulting. We have another individual that has a degree in finance with significant previous experience with PGE as a financial analyst looking at their debt. And then we have Steve Buckley, who is an attorney that does a lot of ERISA work in Portland and also Taft-Hartley work in Portland as an attorney. And then we have Pat West, who is a member of the coalition. Previously, he was a battalion chief for the city of Salem. And then we have Lawrence Fernstall, who was, I think, the youngest CFO for the University of Chicago Medical Center back before he became CFO for OHSU. So significant financial exposure and background. We, again, are primarily looking at, we don't deal with legislation, that's your purvey. We do not want to deal with, the politics of the different constituency groups, and let me tell you that there's a lot of people that want to talk to us, but we are very, very careful about that to make sure that we stay removed from that, and that includes letters to the editor, presentations, things that we think would abridge our responsibilities as fiduciaries. I can tell you this in terms of background prior to pension reform, because I started my business as a financial consultant in 1973, I would be sitting with some of my peers and we would be shaking our heads saying, how can they do this in terms of this level of benefits? Why are these annuity rates as high as they are? Why is this money match producing these kinds of benefits? And now I understand better some of the systemic issues that were involved and what previous boards did or did not do, as the case may be. And trust me, this board was not going to be doing any of those shortcuts or arrangements that compromised, I think, proper decision-making back before pension reform in 2003, because we're paying the price for that right now. The plans... we work very closely with Milliman. Matt knows that we know what we're talking about. We will pose questions. There's checks and balances. I hired Director Roadman, so I currently understand his background and his not only with PERS but also overall in terms of his legal background. So we have a very talented group of individuals that serve at the pleasure of the governor on the PERS board. And as long as I'm continuing to chair the board, which hopefully will be until my term is up in March of next year, we'll continue to try to strive for a five-person constituency, a five-person majority vote. Not majority, but total unanimity. And a lot of it comes down to making sure that you articulate the issues, that people do their homework, that you have good discussions at the board level, that you do all the vetting. And when it comes down to decision-making, it really is pretty apparent as the way that it should be, the decision should be made. And that's rate setting, assumed interest rates, some of the administrative opportunities that we have by statute, because we do have some degree of independence in terms of plan administration. So we're very, very reflective about that, and we appreciate the role that we're serving, and we understand how important it is in this particular economic and environment, and we clearly understand what's going on in other municipalities and entities around the country, and we do not want to see Oregon get compromised as some states and entities have been compromised.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions? I was just curious about how you get the board gets its information when making decisions, and if you could walk us through your relationship with the PERS agency, how you get the information, if Milliman's contacted, how does all of that work?
Okay. Everything we have is on the PERS website, but it's voluminous. I probably have 4 feet of actuarial reports, white paper reports, assumptions, financial modeling, and review that before each meeting. There's a significant amount of homework that's done. The chair and the vice chair meet prior to the meeting, because there's, you only have two people on a board meet before it becomes a public hearing, as you know. And so we thoroughly discuss that. So by the time we get to the meetings, there's obviously input that is provided by testimony. But it's not input that we're not anticipating, because we've already read the letters that have been submitted to us and any issues that Steve said are going to be issues, and please be prepared to discuss this accordingly. So, I mean, long answer to the short question, we do get a lot of information.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry, I should have stated my question differently. I appreciate that. The yes, you receive the information, but when the are there moments where you are proactively stating things like the question we're asking today? You know, what is happening regarding the future, and are we on the right track, and should there any be, if changes need to occur, about, do you feel, does the PERS board have once a year that's reviewed, or is it more reactive?
We review all the issues as far as rates, which are tied to benefits.
Is this in statute? Is this in the policies? Is this because you're the board? And how is it determined what's going to happen at each
statute,
board meeting?
Because we have to set rates. We have to set assumed interest rates, and we also set what the funding requirements are going to be to all the employers. We rely on staff to do much of the heavy lifting there. but we clearly are aware of the methodology. We review it. We have met on more than one occasion with the Oregon Investment Council. So we know what the capital markets are all about because we base our decision-making on, in part, what they're sharing with us and what Milliman is sharing with us as far as their market analysts. So all that information goes into our background material, and then we in turn use that by, again, statute that we have to address each year. There are certain times during the course of each year that certain decisions have to be made, and those decisions are predicated on the information that has been received on an ongoing basis. So there's very little, nothing that happens mm-hmm. in a vacuum. It's all tied to information as provided, and Director mm-hmm. Rodman is extremely good about that. We are aware of issues as far as, you know, the legislature and pending bills, and we have been asked to do, Director Rodman and his staff have been asked to provide different iterations as to what would this mean as far as rate adjustments. So we are aware of those, but we're not legislators. Mm-hmm. That's not something that we do. If you were to ask us, you know, in the sidebar conversation as, you know, a senior legislator, we'd probably share individually, you know, what we might be thinking, but those decisions are not tied to what we do as a board, because sure. What transcends everything is the fiduciary part of it, regardless of what we may have as a personal predisposition.
Okay. Chair Taylor, if I may, there is a statutory directive that says to the PERS board to publish a report every 2 years on the system status, basically the assets, the liabilities, the projections. That is in statute and a directive to the board. They actually produce that every year. They have to do it every two. We do it every year.
Mm-hmm.
So they have different purposes and focus.
I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah, but they are published. Matt's firm is engaged with those valuation reports, and that's why you hear me say this is the system statuses of the 12/31/15 valuation. Mm-hmm. That's a reference to the valuation report as the end of that calendar year that went through all that assessment. Now, bless his heart, they are not that easy to get through, but that information is available. What we do then as staff is try to bring that information to you as decision makers so you're aware of the system status, and also publicly to the stakeholders so that they understand what the dynamics are that are changing as we go through those reviews. But
The challenge is that, you know, the forensics are there, the history is there, is how do you make a presentation and bring it into something that people clearly understand. And Senator Hanselman's talked about, you know, the history. I mean, we clearly it's there's three different plans, and you're grandfathered in a plan that you were in at the time you started. But every plan is a little bit different. OPSERP doesn't have a member account. It's strictly IAP. You've got Tier 2 have frozen member accounts, and you have Tier 1 that have member accounts. But the interest accrediting is only tied to the assumed interest rate, not the pass-through rates that we saw from 1997 to 2003, which was 93%, with a peak in 2000 at 100% of final pay for a 30-year employee. You're not going to see that again. That's history. But it's to try to communicate why things happened the way they did. You'd have to go back and be on one of those boards. And at times, the 12-person board was all PERS members. There are other times that the 12-person board did have some non-PERS participation. Right now, that's not going to happen because it's only a 5-person board, and only three have to be non-PERS representatives. So hopefully there's that level of checks and balances. And I think also in the past that the board chair has always been chosen from the lay group, not from individual that would represent the coalition or the individual that represents the department head. And again, just for transparency purposes, and because we don't have, as a layperson, a vested interest in being a beneficiary, we clearly have a vested interest in making sure that the beneficiaries have what have been promised. But if the cost gets to a point where it's perceived to be not sustainable, there's not much we can do about it, because we're not going to equivocate on rate making, because we are going to make sure the plan is funded as the plan benefits currently are configured.
I kind of have a technical question.
Sure, Senator.
Matt, there's been proposed a change in the annuity rate. So could you talk to me a little bit about the difference between an annuity rate and the pension guarantee rate or whatever that they set for annuity versus an assumed rate for earnings? And can those two be different? And, you know, does it make sense in your mind as an actuary for those two to be different?
Thank you, Chair Taylor. Senator Canope, I might ask for one clarification on your question so that I answer it properly, which is when you make the reference to an annuity rate, are you thinking in particular of reference to, say, for example, the private markets with annuities?
Yes.
Okay. So from my perspective as an actuary, there's private market annuities, and those are provided by insurance providers on an individual basis, and they are priced on an individual level. Included in that pricing is an interest rate to represent the time value of money. That interest rate is a bit of a proxy because it reflects not just the time value of money, but also other requirements that private insurers have to account for when offering individual annuities. Those factors include profit. You've got a profit margin you need to build in, you've got reserving requirements, and you've got some restrictions in terms of how insurers can invest the money proceeds that they receive to sell an annuity to someone. There is certainly a pronounced gap between what you might see in the private market interest rates right now, which might hover in, say, the 3-4% range, and the way that the annuitizations take place in the Oregon PERS program, which are they're annuitized at the whatever the board adopted investment return assumption is. So for a given amount of money or a given amount of account, the lower the interest rate that you use to annuitize, the lower the monthly benefit, which is reflective of the time value of money. So actuarially, whatever rate is used, it can be calculated. So, the questions about, can you use a different rate are, primarily down to policy decisions from an entity like the legislature rather than anything that would be actuarially driven. If we have a policy proposal that comes forward to us that we're asked to analyze, like one that lowers the annuity rate, one thing we have to be very cognizant of is individual member behavior. Because if we felt like there was a major policy proposal and it was going to change the benefits available to certain individual members significantly, the cost savings of such a policy proposal would be contingent on members not retiring prior to the proposal taking effect. And so when we have concepts like that are put forward to us from the agency for analysis, one thing we'll often do is provide a little bit of a range of saying, okay, we've identified these people who will be significantly affected by this proposal, and here's what the cost savings would be if half of them retire before the proposal came effective, or if a quarter or two-thirds of them, for example.
Senator Taylor, can I just quickly respond to Senator Canope? Mm-hmm. Back when the money match in those years of the late 1990s, they were using an annuity rate that was understating mortality, life expectancy, and they also did not include cost of living, mm-hmm. which represents about 25%. We have changed, this board has changed the mortality assumptions to reflect what actually is taking place, not use these old assumptions. So those annuity rates, the fact that there were no commissions and no admin expenses, but they still were skewed clearly in favor of PERS versus a commercial insurance company.
Just follow up?
Yes.
So, John, based on the market today, would you say that PERS's annuity rate is skewed based on what you see in either in other plans with your other clients or in other states, perhaps?
I think it's still probably higher for a number of reasons that could be better explained by Director Rodman. There's only 28% of the people that are under the money match anymore, so that really is going away, and that's really where it was exacerbated. So the full formula is it's a little bit different, but we did tie in new mortality tables, which has impacted funding accordingly.
Steve, did you want to speak to it, or are you?
Sure. We'll follow a deliberative process in looking at what the assumed rate ought to be. That will be driven by the analysis that Matt's team will do, as well as by the OIC and the kind of the first step in that process. And we'll look at that in July, as we do every year. In terms of comparing to private sector, I think, as Matt said, two different drivers of the rate because they're serving two different purposes. As to other states, Oregon is very much in the middle, if not the low middle, of our assumed rate in terms of what other systems use. We've dropped it twice over the last 2 years. So 2 years ago, we dropped to the 7.5, and 2 years before that, we dropped from 8 to 7.75. So the point is, we're very deliberate about the process. We follow what the evidence leads us to, and we will make a decision this July about what the proper rate should be based on the inputs we get from the professionals.
Just follow up.
Yes.
Sorry. Is there a policy that the Purse Board has as it relates to how quickly they would drop that rate, or could you go from 7.5 to 5, or are you going up? Is there a policy that you go a quarter of a point or half a point at a time?
Senator Taylor, Chair Taylor, Senator Culp, there is no limit stated by policy. We move to what the right number is, based again on the evidence and the advice that we get.
And go ahead. I'm sorry. Chair.
Did you need to comment on something?
It is something that is carefully reviewed, Senator Knopp, and Callan and Associates represent the OIC. We were just a little bit under what they proposed. We were a little bit over what Milliman proposed. A lot of states have made adjustments, 25 to 50 basis points. The yin and the yang of it is if you went down to 5%, the amount of funding required based on present value would be huge because you've got to now assume more contributions because less emphasis is going to be placed on earnings. So it's that delicate balance.
Senator Monson, I think
you've addressed it with your question, but I just want you to repeat it again. I mean, the economy's going really well now, and they keep saying it's not going to go really well. And remind me again the impact that our investments have on the unfunded liability and the rate that the employers would have to pay. Just remind me again.
Sure. Chair Taylor, Senator Mona Sanderson goes back to, as Matt referenced, my favorite formula, benefits, contributions, earnings. If earnings, when we set contributions, we assume, we not only know what earnings we have, we assume a rate of earnings in the future, and that's 7.5% in the 2015 valuation, 7.5% over the next 20 years. We'll look at that assumption again as Matt's firm is looking at the 2016 valuation, which that's the work we will do this summer to look at what the right rate would be. If that rate goes down, the E goes down, the C has to go up because the B is constant. So just basic algebra, you have to solve the equation. So if the assumed rate goes down, or if, in fact, investments do not return what we assume, contributions have to go up to make up that hole. That's where you get another sliver of unfunded liability created.
Okay. So in the interest of time here, does anybody have any other questions? I think we're going to move on to review Senator Knope's bills, unless anybody has any other questions for now. Okay, thank you all very much. Steve Rogman knows where he has to be at all times, not very far away from, at least from me, so that I can have him nearby for questions. Thank you both for coming. It was helpful.
And I would like to say, Madam Chair, that John Thomas and I went to school together. We were over at Willamette same year, graduated the same year, hadn't seen him since 68, really. So I had no idea he was head of the PERS board.
Okay. Well, there you go.
And John, thank you for your service as well.
Yes.
We really appreciate
thank you.
Yes. All right. So next we're going to hear from the PERS. We're going to have the expert analysis of Senate Bill 559, 560, and 913. We're going to hear N5607 amendments. Before we start the analysis, I want to mention two emails that the committee received from the public regarding PERS. One was from one of Senator Johnson's. Perhaps you could go over these with us. And then they wanted to have their statements read on the record. But which one is from Senator Johnson?
Okay, so one is a proposal from Senator Johnson's constituent.
Right.
The other one's an email. I don't think he wanted it read on the record.
Oh, okay. Which one is the?
So the follow-up email, he had originally proposed a voluntary buyout option for PERS members, and he just wanted to clarify that what he was hearing during the meeting was that the focus was on people pre-retirement and that he was proposing a buyout for a post-retirement PERS beneficiary.
Okay. All right. Okay.
So the second one, don't think I have it with me.
That's okay. We can make a note to go over the next time. That's okay. Now we're going to, excuse me, we have a PowerPoint that we're going to go over regarding the bills. I have a frog in my throat here. So why don't you, we have it right here. So do you want to tell us what the format's going to be?
So the format will be similar to the way it was with the review of the public proposals. On each slide will be on the left side a list of the criteria that were that the experts were asked to review the proposals. And on the right side will be the proposals in order. So it'll have either the bill as a whole or each amendment on an individual screen so that the committee will have an opportunity to ask about the proposal in regard to the criteria.
Okay, great. So we'll go ahead and get started, Debbie. So, Senate Bill 559. This is about changing the final average salary under PERS. Calculates the greater of the member's average annual salary. Before I go on, I want to bring to everyone's attention that on OLIS, there is a preliminary analysis of the bills and the amendments, so people can look at those. And some of the bills and amendments have an actuarial analysis that's been completed, and that is on OLIS as well. Is that all correct what I said, Debbie? Everything I said? I think so.
And
so,
under what, when you go to the bill, what tag?
So if maybe she can walk you through. We'll go ahead and start chatting, and we're going to have and Deborah can help them get all situated. How's that sound? Welcome, everyone. Why don't we go ahead and have all of you say your name and who you're with, and we can get that out of the way.
I'm Marisa James, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel,
and the drafter of all of these bills, correct, and amendments. Yep. Is that correct? Okay. Hello.
Senator Taylor, members of the committee. Madeline Zike, I'm the state's Chief Human Resources Officer.
Welcome.
And Steve Rodman, Executive Director of PERS.
Yes. I wonder how many times Mr. Rodman's had to say that. So, so Senate Bill 559, again, we talked about this before, and Senator Canope went over this with us. But so everyone understand, it changes the calculation of final average salary, calculates greater of members' average annual salary in 5 calendar years of members' highest annual salary before members' retirement or 1/5 total salary in the last 60 months of active membership, excludes from final average salary calculation any lump sum payment for accrued vacation pay, requires recalculation of employer contribution rates to reflect savings attributable to ACT, and makes corrected rates effective July 1, 2017. So who wants to start with this one? Who would feel the most comfortable going over that? Steve or Marissa, you want to go over the constitutionality? Should we go through constitutional analysis first?
Sure. Chair Taylor, so I don't believe that this bill does anything with regard to vacation pay, but I could.
I think that I'm a little bit confused here. I was reading that, and I'm concerned that this is the final average salary. This has the vacation pay in there.
At least the summary says that it only does the 5-year final average salary. We're going to talk about sick leave and vacation pay later.
In a different also, one. I want to bring to everyone, Deborah has been working very, very hard, and she has been very sick. Is here. She's barely holding up over here. She's got all sorts of medicine next to her and et cetera. And she worked from home even when she was ill. Yesterday, Senator Canope wanted to know how she was being treated, and if there's potentially an error on the PowerPoint, I ask everyone to be kind to our administrator. We could just go ahead and talk about the preliminary analysis.
Sure.
And start with that. So let's talk about the final average salary calculation from 3 to 5 years starting January 1, 2018.
Okay, so Chair Taylor, I want to remind everybody, since we're going to talk about the constitutionality of all of these measures, about the questions that we ask about PERS changes with regard to constitutionality. First, does it affect a term of the PERS contract? If it does not affect a term of the PERS contract, then the legislature can make changes without protecting accrued benefits.
Mm-hmm. Can you speak a little more directly into the microphone?
If it does affect a term of the PERS contract, then it must protect benefits accrued before the effective date of the change. And then there's also the Supreme Court has given us a little bit of information about the irrevocability exception that would prevent the legislature from making changes in certain circumstances. There's explicit irrevocability, which is more than just saying saying shall in the statute, but we don't know a lot about what that means. And then there's implied irrevocability, which comes into play when performance takes a long time to complete, and so it would be unfair to change the benefits while the employee is still completing their performance. So this first one gives us a 5-year final average salary. The employee would get the greater of the 3 years final average salary before the effective date, or five years anytime, basically. And because it appears to protect accrued benefits, it appears to meet the Morrow standard. This one has the same issue as we discussed with the $100,000 final average salary cap, where there could be different ways to apply the new 5-year final average salary. And this court hasn't given us a lot of direction about what it means to protect accrued benefits. So there's a potential that it could be unconstitutional in application, but I believe that the way the bill is put together does meet the Morrow standard for protection of accrued benefits.
Okay, that is very helpful. Thank you. All right. Should we just go down the line here? Or are you?
Sure. Okay. So Madeline Zike again for the record.
That's okay. I think once we say it at the beginning, is that correct, Debbie? That's fine. We don't have to keep saying it. Just good. To save Steve, if no one else.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So this one isn't one that I have much to contribute on from a collective bargaining perspective. When we get to some of the others, I want to give you more information that we've gotten from our legal counsel about those implications. But this one really, I think, is in the purview of the courts. And not something we would address in collective bargaining.
Okay, interesting. Okay, Mr. Rodeman.
Thank you. So we are fortunate in the sense that we've worked with Senator Knope for a while on these concepts, and the fortunateness of this is that we have an actuarial analysis that says if this were to be adopted, this is what we expect the reductions would be. What you see in this preliminary analysis is we have engaged the actuary to say how much would employer rates be reduced if this benefit reduction were to be adopted effective January 1 of 2018. That's not to say that's exactly what the bill does. It is how we had to make assumptions for the actuary to do their work. So all I'm trying to say is there may be some changes around the margins of these numbers depending on the actual terms of the bill. Passed this, so we have a number as far as what the rates would be reduced. That's the information you see reflected in the analysis. Legislative fiscal has then taken that rate reduction and applied it to the employer contribution rates and PERS costs in 2017-19. So that's where you see the LFO making some projections on the savings to general fund under impact state and local budgets and impact on employer contribution rates. That's where the numbers you see are derived from. So we worked very cooperatively with LFO to generate that.
Okay.
That having been said, I would say a couple of things about this concept in particular relating to those changes. The actuarial analysis said that the employer contribution rate effect, if this were adopted, would be a reduction of employer rates of 0.65%. When you're talking about employer contribution rates that should be at 29%, you're taking 0.65 off of that number. So by one measure, that doesn't sound like it's much of a reduction, 0.65 off of 29%. On the other hand, when you apply that 0.65 to the $20 billion PERS payroll in 17-19, that's a lot of money. So small changes in PERS generate a lot in savings. And that's where you need to look at the relativeness of the change in relation to not only how much does it affect employer rates, but how much then money would reductions actually occur. The caution, though, again, as to looking at 17-19 impacts is remember we're under a rate collar. So as I said, this reduction is off of that 29% employer rate. We're not at 29% because we are collared rates and we're going through increases in rates over the next several biennia. If this concept were to be adopted, when we finally get to the top rate, that top rate would be lower by 0.65%. But we're not projected to get there for at least two or three biennia. So Legislative Council has inserted a provision in this legislation that says PERS Board will recalculate 2017-19 rates if this is passed. Absent specific direction from the legislature, that recalculation is going to not change because all you're doing is eating into that margin that the rate collar has already weighed off. You can certainly tell the PERS Board to actually apply that rate reduction to the 17-19 rates. You did that in 2013. You could do it again. But then if you say lower 2017-19 rates, you're keeping that same growth that you still need to make up in the next subsequent biennia. So it's a question of do you want to shave it off out here or do you want to start lower over here? And again, it's a marginal change. I won't be as belabored on that point in each of these concepts, but I thought
it's
important.
No, it's fine.
To
it's very helpful.
Dynamic.
So, okay, it's very helpful. I appreciate that. The does anybody have any questions on this amendment, Senator Knope? Want to be mindful that these are your bills and amendments. So, is there something you probably already knew all of that? So, is there anything else you want to add?
I do not have anything to add.
Okay. All right.
I do have a question.
Yes,
so,
sir.
The amendments are already included in the discussion document then? We're not talking about the bill and separately the amendments, but we brought them together.
So you'll see on OLIS the individual, this is 559.
Yeah.
In, at the, it is introduced. And then there's going to be Senate Bill 560, and then there's going to be amendments. And the amendments, they could have been standalone bills, but we're treating them as amendments to Senate Bill 560. Does that make sense?
Okay. So 559 does not have any amendments?
Correct. It does not have any amendments.
Gotcha. Oh, you said amendments, and
I
wasn't.
I, you know what? You are correct. I did, and that was incorrect of me, and I apologize,
no
Senator
problem.
Hanselman. So let's go ahead, and if everyone's, this is your chance to, here we have the preliminary analysis. I want to make certain everyone sees these are just preliminary. There's an enormous amount of work that's gone in by staff to review all of these. So this is, and we can circle back in the end. I also want everyone to be aware of the fact that these bills and amendments they cannot be combined to create one total of quote-unquote savings. What if you, if for example, if a member here said, I would like to pursue, you know, two of the amendments, for example, an additional actuarial analysis will need to occur for those two amendments to see what the interplay will be between them. The bills, the concepts here, one cannot just simply create a spreadsheet and say at the grand total there is X number of dollars, for example, for savings, because they would impact each other. Does that make sense for everybody? So, okay.
So a question on this then. So in reading the impact on public employee benefits, it says tier one, it would have very little impact, and as well as tier two, but OFSERP would really, they would be the ones that are really affected. So I just want to keep in mind, you know, what impact. Tier one, it's gravy train for them. Tier two, yeah. And then OPSERP is, I just want us to remember.
I think that's an excellent point, Senator Monis Anderson. These, we're talking about our, you know, these are our public employees who are, these are the retirement, their retirement programs, and when we make these changes, the ramifications are different, perhaps,
for tier one, tier two, and for OPSERP. And so we do need to be careful of
And it isn't the OPSERP that has caused the problem. It's the tier one that's caused. And just tier one just needs to die off, but that'll be a while.
Okay. So, Senator Gelser.
Yeah.
She did not quite mean that, I don't think. But, okay.
No, I was about to say I was going in a similar vein. But so another way to look at it is this could save us some money. We could have increased rates, but that money would come from the benefits of younger workers in order to pay off a debt incurred by people that have already retired. And the impact would be as this younger workforce moves into retirement, they would not have the same financial security as those that they saved by sacrificing their retirement benefit in order to reduce rate payments.
Precisely, Senator Gelser.
Yeah, so thank you for that. So anytime anything needs to be clarified, this is definitely, or any comments, this is the time to do that. So let's go ahead and move to the next. Thank you, Debbie. So Senate Bill 560, I'm going to go ahead and I won't read everything that's up there, but more or less changes the calculation of a PERS member's final average salary by capping maximum includable salary at $100,000, and it redirects employee contributions from their IAP account to a newly created account that will be used to fund member pensions. There are, just so everyone's clear, and Senator Hansel, there are seven amendments to Senate Bill 560. But first, to the bill about final average salary and capping at $100,000.
Okay, Chair Taylor, so this one has two pieces, like we just talked about. You've got the $100,000 cap, which it says that after 2018 that you the salary that will be considered in the calculation of final average salary is capped at $100,000 because the employees have not earned that salary before the change takes place. I think it comports with the Morrow standard for protection of accrued benefits. We discussed the other day, Greg Hartman made the point that you could apply this differently, and he thinks that it should be applied differently. As I said on the last concept, the court hasn't given us a lot of direction on how to protect accrued benefits in a circumstance like this, so there are different ways to do it. I think the bill does meet the Morrow standard, but there could be differences of opinion on that. And then the other part of the concept is the redirection of the employee contributions, which currently go into the IAP, the individual account program. So those the contributions after the effective date of the change would go into a new account to be used to pay for pension benefits accrued on and after the change. So because it only applies those contributions to pay for pension benefits accrued after the change, I think it comports with Morrow. If you tried to pay for pension benefits accrued before the change, I don't think it would. Yeah, and this one is a little complicated in how you're going to determine what the pension benefits accrued before the changes. So that could be an area for litigation if this concept were to pass.
I'm sorry, can you go into more detail? What would be the, can you make sure everyone understands? Because some of these concepts, if I may say, I mean, we ought to make certain, I'd like to know, at least I'll speak for myself, about the risk of it being referred to the court. So can you go over that point in a little more detail, please?
Chair Taylor, so surprisingly, I'm not much of a math person, but I can imagine that different people could have different opinions on how you should calculate what pension benefits have been accrued and so what this new account will be used to pay for. Steve might be able to talk a little bit more if he understands what I'm talking about.
So the challenge, of course, would be to make sure that the member contribution only funds the member's benefit going after or accrued after this date. I think given the relative cost of those, the normal cost that we've talked about, that's not a mathematical concern. It's more of a theoretical concern. But I think I understand the vulnerability to make sure that a contribution made after this effective date only funds the benefits after that effective date. And that's what Marisa's trying to make sure we
okay.
follow that.
Just a question on
yes,
that.
Senator
so 560, it will affect all retirees benefit what they get back,
no.
or the, only sure. those that are going to retire in determining what their benefit is.
Chair Taylor, Senator Monis Anderson, it won't affect anybody. So I'm sorry, which piece, the 100,000 or the 6% redirect?
Both then.
Okay. To the 100,000, the 100,000 is a limit on what counts towards final average salary. So your if you earned more than that prior to, nothing to do with people who have already retired, only to do with people who will retire after the law becomes effective. The whatever that person makes in salary after the effective date of the law, no more than 100,000 can count toward their final average salary. So if you already made that much, then you're capped. If you don't make that much, it doesn't affect you. As to the 6% redirect, whatever percentage is chosen, that redirection would be of the individual account contribution. Instead of going into your individual account, it would go into a pension funding account.
But not for those that have already retired.
Nope, none of these concepts affect anybody that's already retired.
I just
retired.
Wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
None of these do.
Thank you, Senator Monis Anderson. Risa, could you please clarify for us, for all the bills, the 559, 560, and 913 that are before us, they are, I believe it's 913, is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. That none of these impact people who are retired.
Chair Taylor, that's right.
Because
retired members have accrued all their benefits, so under MORA we can't do anything.
So we're talking about any impact on Tier 1, Tier 2, and OPSERP, if any, going forward. So just to clarify that. So okay. Did you want? Yes.
Sure. Chair Taylor, so this is
maybe
where,
put the mic near you, please.
Thank you. I usually have such a loud voice. It's not a problem. Chair Taylor, this is the 6% redirect is where we find some complication within our current labor contracts. So since 1979, and I actually have people in my office that remember this, we've had language in the contracts that states that in the event of the state's payment, in the event that the state's payment of a 6% employee contribution must be discontinued, the state will increase by 6% the base salary rates for each classification in the salary schedules in lieu of the 6% pickup.
What year was that from? Excuse me.
1979, I understand. I understand that language has been in there since 1979. So where this complicates things for us is the contracts, the labor agreements specifically call this out. And so any dispute about whether or not we would need to do this if the 6% was redirected would, in the opinion of our legal counsel, and I'm going to provide the memo, I think you may have it already, Deborah, but if not, after the hearing, would probably go through the grievance arbitration process that the labor contracts go through when you have some dispute in the language in the contracts. And so they'd look at the intent, what was the intent of this language. And if we couldn't get to agreement with labor regarding what we wanted to do, they could take it to arbitration. This can also be handled in the bargaining process, but we're in the middle of bargaining now, so we're nowhere, I guess, in the early portions of bargaining. So we're just not at this point where we would have this kind of conversation. So that's for the majority of the contracts. But then in 2016, SEIU entered into agreement with us, and they're actually picking up their own 6% of their PERS, so their wages were adjusted, and now they're picking up their own PERS. That was something that was agreed to. So a little bit different in both of those, but looking at a redirect would probably be something that the contract language and the intent of that contract language would really need to be explored by DOJ and then perhaps by an arbiter. So that piece is tricky.
Okay.
Question.
Yes.
I don't understand. In the contract, it says where that 6% goes, or just who pays the 6%?
It says to PERS.
To PERS.
Yeah, it's a PERS pickup that the employer is providing. Other than for SEIU, and we provided them a wage increase, and they pick up their own PERS contribution.
So the contribution within PERS that we're contemplating here, you're not sure meets muster, isn't that going to PERS?
Well, I think what they're saying is if it's not going to, that's where it's subject to contract interpretation. What is the PERS account? Is it an individual account, or as we're talking about, what was the word you used, Steve, a general?
Regular account.
A regular account. Was it for the individual? Was the intent that it was for the actual individual, or was it for the system generally? And so all of those things would need to be looked at to see whether or not that PERS pickup needed to be applied to an individual's account for their individual use, or it could be redirected to a larger account.
Follow up. So you're saying the intent, but maybe not the contract language. Whenever I negotiated contracts, the contract language ruled. If it didn't say it there, it didn't matter what the intent was.
And when our attorney looked at it, they felt like there was some ambiguity in it, and so, as you know from contracts, if there's ambiguity, a third party usually helps you decide. So in this case, it's the Employment Relation Board through the grievance and arbitration process, unless, you know, labor felt like they didn't want to challenge whatever was done.
Senator Knopf?
Yeah, Madeline, I got a couple follow-ups. So you said that it was done in 1979, but I think there's 10, mm-hmm. I think you said once there were 10 unions and 32 contracts or 33 contracts. So is it that way for all of them, that was accomplished in 1979, or did this happen over a period of years with the other contracts?
Senator Knopf, I don't know that for sure. We know this one for SEIU because we were looking at SEIU was in 1979. We've had labor unions come and go, and things have changed. But it is in the language for all of them, with the exception of the SEIU one that I just referenced that was changed last year.
Follow up?
Yes.
And then you mentioned in 2016 that you had agreed to, with the union, that they would pay their 6%. How much did they get in offset for that?
They took a lower COLA than some of the other units, and they had got 6.95% when they made that transition.
Okay. And I think you were going to provide us maybe with the dates of the contracts.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought we'd done that, but I will certainly.
I didn't
do
see
that.
It, Deborah. Did you get it?
Do we have that?
I thought I sent it, but I will definitely do that as soon as
I may have missed
it,
but if you could send it to Deborah so she could get it to everybody.
Absolutely. I can tell you that I went back and looked, and all of our contracts, with the exception of a couple, expire in June of 17. So that's why we're right now in the middle of bargaining, or just starting bargaining, because they expire in June of 17.
Okay. All right. Any other questions before we go into the amendments? Okay. Thank you. All right. So now we are, let's see, I think we're moving to, oh, that's continued. Maybe we could go to the next slide. There we go. So because we like to make things really complicated in the legislature, we'll start with the dash two. Instead of the dash one, and then maybe we'll skip a few in between and then circle back and then do a gut stuff, and you know, and then we'll just make it so everybody really understands what we're doing in our own little insider speak here. So we do not have a dash one amendment, is that correct, Senator Knopf?
I imagine somebody does, but
it's not us.
Not for this purpose.
Okay, so there are seven amendments. The dash two changes the calculation of PERS benefits under the full formula method by decreasing the pension multiplier from 1.67% to 1% of final average salary per year of service for general service members, and from 2% to 1.2% for police and fire members. If you could clarify, I'm going to ask Steve to just clarify some of the language before we start talking about it as a committee, just so that people understand what some of those terms mean.
Thank you, Chair Taylor. So the formula benefit, which is the predominant way that people we calculate benefits these days, one of the elements of that is your statutory factor. So this is where we say, for example, for OPSERP members, if you currently work 30, I'm sorry, I'll use tier one example. If you work 30 years in a tier one position, you will get 50% of your final average salary, because the statutory factor is 1.67. So 30 times 1.67 equals 50. So that's where you get to the 50% of your final average salary. If that multiplier is reduced to 1%, let's just, again, assume you start all over again. that member would get 30% of their final average salary after 30 years instead of 50%, because 30 times 1 is 30, and 30 times 1.67 is 50. Of course, it can't be that easy, because what this law does is apply these reduced statutory factors to the years of service after the effective date of the law. So what we're going to end up doing for someone who maybe spent 20 years of service at that 1.67 factor and then another 5 years of service at the 1% factor is blend those together to come up with a percentage of their final salary that they would get as a benefit.
Does that help clarify? That
sounds hard.
Well, this one is a little more complicated. That's why I wanted him to explain the terminology so that we're all on the same page.
Can I?
Yes.
So if you're doing that for every retiree moving forward, you really would have to do a pretty complex individual calculation for each person, because the number of years of service before January 1st of 2018 isn't going to be the same for everyone until you get to new hires as of January 1st, 2018, and then you just calculate at the what is the risk in that? It seems like a few years ago we were dealing with individuals that were coming to the legislature because there had been errors in the forecast of their PERS benefits, and we had to pass legislation to go back and recoup or change because of the errors in the calculation. Has the system improved since that time, such that with a change like this, we wouldn't be concerned about that, or is that risk inherent in any change in the calculation of the benefit?
Chair Taylor, Senator Gelster, there's a lot to unpack there, so please remind me if I don't hit all the points of it. To your point about what we call data verification, that's what I think you're referring to, where members can come in and ask PERS, what are my years of service? What are the salary records you have for me? And then if they get that verification and subsequently retire, the numbers cannot change. So they lock the numbers in. That's an opportunity that this legislature has given to members. As to the accuracy and some of the challenges that led to the creation of that, we are much better. We have a much lower error rate. To the fact that we have any error rates, of course, is concerning. But we have a much lower error rate where it used to be, I don't even want to speculate. It is much lower. That's why you don't hear about those problems anymore, is because we're much better at it. As to the complexity of this calculation, if I may, Senator Gelster, you should see how we do COLA, because when you pass the lower COLA in 2013, that is exactly the calculation we have to make now. So for everyone who retired prior to 2013, it's easy. Your COLA is 2%. For everyone who retired after 2013, you get your own COLA. Everyone gets their own individual COLA. And similarly with this, everyone gets their own individual multiplier.
Multipliers for everybody.
Okay, so let's talk about, we'll go back to Marisa here then to talk about the -2 amendment and its constitutionality, please.
Chair Taylor, so this does, it only changes the multiplier for service performed on or after January 1st, 2018, and so because, you know, the employee has not performed that service yet, it appears to comport with Morrow. And for the same, implied irrevocability doesn't seem to apply because the employee is serially and continually performing that service. My one concern about this one is that one could argue perhaps that it's explicitly irrevocable. When you're changing the multiplier, you're getting into the core of the defined benefit that PERS offers. And I would expect members to argue that as you lower, at some point, if you lower that factor too low, you've eliminated that benefit, and it's explicitly irrevocable. I don't know how persuasive the court would find that argument. I don't know if these numbers are low enough to trigger such an argument, but I do want to flag that for you.
Okay, thank you. All right. Is there anything you wanted to add to this one?
Nope.
Okay.
Anything? And this does, Madam Chair, affect Tier 1 and Tier 2 members more so than OPSERP.
Maybe we can have
Chair Taylor's. No, because OPSERP members have more years to work after January 1, 2018, typically. So
So it would be the opposite?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Do you want to talk about anything?
If I could just make one point briefly, and that is discussed under item 7 relating to the impact on the workforce and rate of retirements. Again, I want to take the opportunity to emphasize a point. That is that all these changes are prospective. So for all the members that are concerned that you hear from, that we hear from, that say all these things you're talking about, how will that affect my benefit? Again, you can't go back. The legislature cannot reduce benefits already earned. So the if any of these are adopted, all they would do is not say you will not earn retirement benefits going forward. You'll just get less than you were otherwise going to get going forward. So let's say that someone is on the cusp of retirement in 2018, maybe a July 1, 2018 retiree. They would only have 6 months of this reduced factor at 1% over their entire career. It isn't as if this reduction could apply retroactively to when the law becomes effective. So for those 6 months, they would get the 1% instead of 1.67. Obviously, that's lower. Senator Gelser's point, the only way you make benefits, you may save on benefits is to reduce benefits. Sorry, the only way you save money on a system is to reduce benefits going forward. But to just reassure folks that it's not, none of these go back, it's only going forward. You just might get less for the service going forward than you were otherwise going to get.
Thank you. Okay, before we move on to, let's make sure it's actually a dash three. It is dash three. Okay, any questions on the dash two? All right, dash three decreases the assumed interest rate used to convert account balances to monthly lifetime annuities from 7.5% to 3.5%. Steve, I'm going to ask you to just make sure everyone understands what an annuity is, and well, monthly lifetime annuities. I think everyone knows what an annuity is, but just explain what a lifetime monthly annuity, just what the, I'm just making certain that the terminology for those who are watching, turns out people watch us, so make sure everyone understands.
So, Chair Taylor, members of the committee, again, predominantly we calculate benefits two ways, full formula, we've talked to death, statutory factor, final average salary, years of service. This concept does not affect those benefits in any way.
Okay, never mind.
Money match is the other way that we calculate benefits, which is we take a member's account, match it with employer dollars, annuitize that account over time. This bill tells us to annuitize that account at 3.5% instead of annuitizing that account at the assumed rate of return, currently 7.5%. As Matt Larrabee alluded to, you assume or you annuitize at a lower rate, benefit payments are going to go down because you assume you're going to have less investment income over the life of that payout.
Okay. Lisa?
Chair Taylor? There may be no contract right to the use of a certain assumed interest rate, and the court in Strunk, in the Strunk case, found that we could, am I looking at the right, yes, found that there was no contract right to the use of a certain assumed interest rate, and in fact the board has changed it recently, as we just heard. If there is a contract right to it, this is also prospective. It's about the predicting what the growth of money in the future, and so I think it would comport with Morrow anyway. The issue that could arise with this one is that you're using a different assumed interest rate for one part of the money that PERS is holding on to, and a different assumed interest rate for other parts. So that's a potential argument. Senator Knope has a counter argument to that one that we heard before, but I just want to note that for you. So
yeah, I wonder about that. Yeah, no, thank you. Do you have?
I don't have anything else on this one.
The only thing I would note is covered under the technical issues. That is, the legislation is drafted tells us to use 3.5% for all of our actuarial factor tables. We actually use actuarial factor tables for a number of purposes. So we would need to work with legislative counsel to narrow the focus of these changes down to just when you're annuitizing benefits for money match, if that's all you want to affect. And I would urge you, that's all you want to affect if you want that to move forward. You don't want to affect all the other actuarial factors that we use.
So for a private plan, a private retirement plan, and you were doing that, I mean, how is that rate set? I mean, is it the same I'm trying to understand about who's where the advice would come. If we went from 7.5% to 3.5%, would there be who would be coming to consult with the PERS board? I mean, who would be in the room making that? I mean, besides the legislature advising, this sounds like a pretty serious decision.
I think maybe my clarification muddied things, because I'm not talking about who would advise us on it. My point was we use actuarial factor tables for a number of purposes. Right. So, for example, when an individual converts their retirement from an individual retirement to a joint and survivor annuity, meaning we add another measuring life, there's an actuarial factor conversion so that those annuities are the same, are actuarially equivalent. To assume a 7.5 rate of return over that is a different result than a 3.5 rate of return over that. So my point was, I think the intent of this is just to affect money match annuitization. The, as drafted, it does not do that. As drafted, it affects all of the actuarial tables we use.
Okay, all right.
We just need to narrow the focus of it.
Okay, thank you. Now I'm a little more clear. Okay, I misunderstood. Okay, thank you. All right, any questions? Senator Knope, okay. So this is moving on to dash four. Okay, changes the definition of salary for purposes of calculating final average salary for Tier 1 and Tier 2 PERS members by excluding any lump sum payment for accumulated unused vacation leave or other unused paid leave accrued on or after January 1, 2018. I think that's pretty straightforward, the concept, pretty straightforward. Lisa?
Oh, Chair Taylor, yes, so currently, depending on your tier, you can use sick and vacation leave as part of your final average salary. This would disallow that for sick and vacation leave accrued on or after January 1, 2018. And because it's prospective and the employee hasn't earned that sick or hasn't accrued that sick or vacation leave yet, I believe it it complies with Morrow. I would note that this could be another complicated one because employers would have to keep track of sick leave. They might have to keep two separate banks of sick leave and vacation leave accrued and used before the January 1, 2018 and earned and used after January 1, 2018. I don't know how complicated that is for employers, but it's a note.
All right. You must have, do you have something on this one?
A little bit. I think she's right. That would be complicated for employers. Unfortunately, for example, here at the state, we have these old mainframe antiquated systems that may require some reprogramming for that. We didn't do any estimate on that so far, but that is a bit of a complication in there. And then this one, like the others that have been outside of the 6% pickup that's called out in our contract language, we are not sure that this would need to be bargained, and again, something our attorneys would want to look at. But unlike the 6%, some of these changes to the PERS program that PERS controls by statute, our legal counsel is telling us that probably those would not have to be bargained, nor the impact of those.
Okay, so if a bill was passed or this amendment were passed and right now obviously through the CBAs their vacation and unused paid leave, they obviously some can, I suppose it depends on if you're which where each contract's probably different of whether or not you can carry it over, has to use it up, end of the year, et cetera. But if the legislature said this is how it's going to be across the board, so that would be for local public employers in addition to the state, it would just be across the board, as you understand it?
So, Chair Taylor, I think the way I was thinking about it is this would be the use of sick and vacation leave for the purposes of PERS credit. So okay. The way they use their leave within their own, you know,
right.
agency would not change by this. This is really, as I understand it, the way it's applied upon retirement.
Okay.
Question.
Yeah, Senator Norris.
So do we know how many people just don't get sick?
Right, or don't use their?
You know, I know employees that take their 1 day or 2 days every month. But then I know other employees that don't take anything, like my father, who only missed 1 day in 32 years of service in the school system. So, you know,
So if I may, because I do know the answer.
Oh, good. All right.
To your point, Chair Taylor, Senator Mona Sanderson, I refer you to the Milliman letter that analyzes this because the impact is quite varied across the different groups we look at. So, for example, on the assumed sick leave, how much does that add to final average salary for, so it's a range. For local police and fire, that range is highest. So that local police and fire group are the ones with the biggest sick leave balances when they actually retire. But lowest is general service females. So people who in public employment, not police and fire, not school district, they use more sick leave. So the impact varies quite a bit, and that's in the table that's in the Milliman analysis, which would show you the different groups that are impacted by the sick leave and then by the vacation component.
Thank you. Okay. All right. Any other questions on dash four? Okay. We have four more committee members. So dash five is for members of OPSERP who established membership in pension program on or after effective date of act, not including police officers or firefighters, it increases normal retirement age to 67 years of age and early retirement age to 57 years of age, regardless of number of years of active service years, excuse me. So,
Chair Taylor, so this is akin to a new tier. It only applies to basically members hired on or after the effective date. It's a little more complicated than that, but so there are no constitutional concerns if you're changing the deal for people who haven't even been hired yet.
Okay.
Or haven't established membership yet.
Okay.
My only comment is we no longer have any more actuarial analyses for this concept or any of the subsequent ones, so I don't have any numbers to give you.
That is good to know. So we would have to make a decision about having an analysis done.
Right. And Steve, what's the time frame for analysis?
It can depend on the concept, but it's a couple of weeks. I can give you some intuitive feel. This one, for example, is new entrants to the system, and they're only going to – the retirement age is extended 2 years, 30, 40 years from now. To the extent you save money and discount it back to present value, it ain't going to be much.
Okay. Thank you. All right. So let's move on to the dash six, which requires public employers that hire a retired PERS member on or after effective date of act to contribute a percentage of the retired member's salary to PERS that would have been contributed if the retired member were an active member.
So, Chair Taylor, this deals with double dipping. It doesn't have any constitutional concerns for PERS members. Now that I look at it, I'm wondering about an unfunded mandate. I just thought about that, and I haven't had a chance to research it at all. But for members, it has no constitutional concerns.
Okay. May I ask a question?
Yes, of course.
When you're talking about the unfunded mandate, does that go back to the local government question that came up with the sick leave?
Chair Taylor, Senator Gelser, I'm not sure what question with the sick leave.
Of putting a cost on local employers.
Oh.
Is that the unfunded mandate that you're talking about?
Well, Senator Gelser, yeah. So the reason I just thought about it is because the public employer isn't really getting any benefit for this nobody's getting any benefit for this contribution, really. I would have to look into that one a little farther, but it would require local governments to make these payments, so it just flashed into my mind.
Okay. Any other questions? I mean, I'll go along here, moving along.
Anything more for me on that one?
Okay. The I think that there was some discussion somewhere about, and another day, committee members, we're going to have a hearing on the future of public employees at the state level. In all seriousness, we're going to be talking about the age of our current workforce.
Okay.
Who's eligible for retirement. I'm understanding from different agency directors that we have some agencies where there's a considerable number of people who either could retire or close to retirement. And yes, that we want to talk about that regarding PERS, but we also want to be mindful of the impact that would have on the work of the actual agencies. We have a lot of expertise within our different agencies, and if people
you know, retire and there isn't a replacement plan of what that means. We'll be doing that in another day. But is there any other questions for the Dash 6 amendment?
I had some of the material I have. There's a Dash 8 and a Dash 9. They're not being considered there.
Oh, yeah, we have. We're going to go over those two.
Oh, I thought we were getting ready to adjourn. Sorry.
No, I apologize. I said we have four more because, again, we can't make anything simple. For I remember when I first started coming around the legislature, I'm like, what's a Dash 1? And it's not really, you know, intuitive, I don't think, to the average person. Now we're going to talk about, there's no Dash, well, we do not have a Dash 7 in this committee. Senator Canope referred to Dash 1 and Dash 7, meaning that someone has requested it, but that is not a request made by Senator Canope, and it does not appear to have been by anybody on our committee. So the Dash 8 is what we're going to talk about now, increases the waiting period to become a PERS member from 6 to 12 months.
Chair Taylor, this one also is like a new tier. It only applies to members employed after the effective date, so there are no constitutional concerns.
Okay. And then, again, when we talk about the future of public employees, that's the kind of thing that Ms. Syke will be able to inform us about, is how many people are at these different levels so we can make more informed decisions about any potential changes to the state's retirement system. Mr. Roodman, anything on the Dash 8?
No, only to speculate again what the impact might be. Because this only applies to new entrants into the system, that's OPSERP. OPSERP members already get their six-month waiting time as credit when they go through and invest in the system 5 years later. So this only would pull people out who make it past 6 months but not quite a year. They're not going to vest anyway. So I doubt there's going to be any much of a change in the dynamics of the system as far as the number of people who qualify for benefits.
Okay. Any questions on the Dash 8? Okay, last one. The Dash 9 increases number of service hours required in a calendar that year to become PERS member from 600 to 1,000 hours. Also requires PERS members to complete at least 1,000 service hours in each of 5 calendar years to become vested in the pension program.
Chair Taylor, again, this only applies to members who establish membership on or after the effective date, so there's no constitutional concerns.
All right. And this will also be,
What effect, if any, would it have on unfunded liability?
Mr. Redman?
Chair Taylor, Senator Mona Sanderson, we haven't done an analysis on this one yet, so we don't know.
Yeah. Nice. But would you like to speculate besides the unfunded liability? Not speculate. Give us your insight.
I will tell you what makes it difficult, and that is, we have a standard out there for membership, which is 600 hours. People manage to that standard, meaning if I'm an astute person who wants to get into PERS, I know I got to get into a job that pays me for at least 600 hours in a calendar year that it's expected to do so. You raise it to 1,000, how is that going to change behavior? How many people are going to drop out of that qualification? And how many people are going to change how many shifts they pick up or how much work or substitute teaching work they're willing to do to get into PERS, because it's that kind of a dynamic, it's really impossible for us to assess.
Okay, what do you want to say?
Yeah, and Senator Taylor, the places that I can think about that in the state system might be firefighters, depending on the length of fire system season, and they come back every year, and those kinds of temporary employees that may come back every year to the state and want to do some part-time work.
Mm. Okay, right. So the before we conclude here, there's been an enormous amount of work done in these preliminary analyses, and I don't really necessarily think it's my position to be assigning homework, if you will, but I really encourage all the committee members to go over these. I'm sorry you didn't have the time over the weekend to do that. The staff has worked very hard, and LFO has also worked hard. They couldn't be here today. But in here, it's broken down, and they've gone through, the three of them plus LFO have gone through each of the criteria and done and summarized for us the impact. So under the LFO section, if they are able to make an estimate of any potential savings that's in there, et cetera. So this is, we all know what the date is within the legislative session, so it's important that we be well-versed and understand Senator Knope's bills, the amendments, the impacts that they would have, et cetera. And again, I want to emphasize that one cannot simply look at one of the amendments or one of the bills and say, okay, if I take these three, it comes to some grand total. There is an interplay between all of them. And if there policy-wise are amendments or bills here that are before us that folks want to have additional analysis done, meaning that we want to see the interplay between some of them, and I think Senator Knope asked about the turnaround time for Milliman, if we want to have the actuaries look at them, then please, after reviewing the analysis in more detail, please bring that to my attention, and we can work with the PERS staff to, with Steve, excuse me, and his staff to get that underway. So we definitely are well informed before we make any decisions, if any. So I'm going to close the informational meeting. Our next meeting is on Monday, March 27th. We're scheduled for public hearings on Senate Bill 41 and 42 concerning employment department matters. Those two bills are at the request of our Governor Brown. And then we are going to have work sessions on Senate Bill 92, Senate Bill 93, and Senate Bill 416 concerning the Department of Consumer and Business Services and from Boley. And I want to, I was very rude of me, I forgot to thank all of you for your very, very hard work. Thank you so much. And we are lovely audience members who really like us and like to keep coming. So thank you. And we're going to adjourn the meeting on the Senate Committee on Workforce. And if people want to look at the three bills that we'll be voting on Monday for the work session, and if anybody has any questions, to definitely contact my office so I can understand any of your concerns. All right. Thank you. All right. Thank you.